Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community. As Drs. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on 97.9 The Hill and on demand at chapelboro.com.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. I'd like to welcome guest co-host Dr. Jamila Battle. Welcome, Jamila.
Thank you.
You know, we've known each other for a good while, and you were one of our great guests with your book on the show, and we were so glad to hear that you might be willing to help join us as a co-host periodically. It's great to have you.
I'm happy to be here.
We're also going to be talking today with Dr. Brian Southwell, Director of the Science and the Public Sphere Program at RTI International, about his new book, Misinformation in Mass Audiences, about health misinformation as a different sort of plague. I'm really looking forward to that conversation.
I certainly am too, especially in this age of sensationalism and fake news.
But first, we're actually going to talk about some real research that matters. And let's dive right in, Jamila, about our very first research on potentially new guidelines for colonoscopy, that colon cancer screening, and about lowering it from 50 to 45. What's this about?
Well, we know colon cancer combined with rectal cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death in the U.S. More than 140,000 Americans are expected to be diagnosed with it, and about 50,000 die from it. But the rate of colon cancer has shot up 51% for people under the age of 50 since 1994, while rates decline in people over the age of 55 because of screening.
Right. So it suggests that we're doing a better job. And I think up to 2/3 of people over the age of 50 are now getting screening. But we still got a lot to go. If it's only 2/3, it means 1/3 aren't getting screening. And yet we're missing a lot of cancers in those under age 50. Seems pretty simple. We should just change the screening guidelines to be 45. Is it that simple?
Well, it's not that simple. There's certainly risk and benefits whenever we are talking about screening tests. But it seems with this new guideline, we would extend colorectal cancer screening to an additional 22 million American adults between the ages of 45 and 49 and send that clear message that colorectal cancer has been on the rise in young adults.
I think the guidelines here may well change. We have the American Cancer Society. A lot of insurance companies go with the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, another guideline of experts that don't just focus on one cancer or disease, and those may change. In the meantime, it seems to me if you have risk for colon cancer and you perhaps would justify getting it done at an earlier age, you should talk with your provider who probably could get it approved. I'm not sure you could get it approved yet in the absence of maybe some risk factors.
And we know traditional risk factors such as family history, certain genetic mutations, irritable bowel disease, but we really don't know what the risk factors are in these younger individuals. What we do know is there's heavier disease burden shown in this data, and hopefully this will spur some active research to further assess the effectiveness, harms, and impact of screening in these younger individuals.
You know, one of the risk factors is actually cigarette smoking. So if you're a cigarette smoker out there, we would encourage you to quit for colon cancer health, among many other reasons. Speaking of different substance use, our next research that matters is on alcohol policies and alcohol-related crash deaths in the U.S.
Alcohol is the established risk factor for car crash deaths. Approximately 30% of deaths come from crashes where one or more drivers had a blood alcohol concentration at or above 0.08, which is the legal limit for driving in the U.S.
And this is actually new research that was in the Journal of the American Medical Association, subspecialty journal, Internal Medicine. And it comes from Boston University and Boston Medical Center. It was looked at national data to help determine are states that have stronger alcohol policies, things like higher alcohol taxes, things like sobriety checkpoints, things that make it more likely that people would not drink and drive. Did that actually reduce alcohol-related deaths?
It found that across all states, actually, a 10% increase in the restrictiveness of policies would translate into approximately 800 fewer deaths annually.
And so this is important because it's not just those who were drunk over that 0.08, but it actually, even in the lower alcohol levels, it helped reduce the likelihood of those crashes. So I think this is really important research. This is something that can save lives. And it's something that's like common sense. If we could strengthen some of the policies that discourage people from drinking and driving, it will actually cut down on drinking-related deaths. Let's talk about our last research that matters, Jamila, about opioids. I know this is something near and dear to you. You do, as our listeners probably remember, work with substance abuse and addiction. And this is about the efforts to decrease opioid amounts in people who use a lot and whether that actually decreases their kind of satisfaction of care with their providers, which may be something important to providers who are maybe scared to reduce their opioid.
And that's right. And as we know, opiate use increased in the U.S. by 300% over the past two decades, and overdose deaths increased 200% over the last decade. And this looked at, would reducing opiates for patients who are prescribed these medications for years for chronic pain decrease patient satisfaction? And in fact, in this Kaiser Permanente study of nearly 2,500 patients who used high doses of opiates, it showed that reducing their opiate use did not lower their satisfaction scores.
Yeah, this is how to create a win-win-win, a win for patients, a win for providers, and a win for our healthcare system. We're going to have our health sciences librarians make sure they put a link to this article from the American Journal of Managed Care on our website. And with that, we're going to actually take a short break because that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Brian Southwell of RTI International and University of North Carolina about his new book, Misinformation in Mass Audiences, The Spread of Health Misinformation. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number two ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jamila Battle. Today on Conversations, Jamila, we're talking with Dr. Brian Southwell, Director of the Science and the Public Sphere Program at RTI International, a UNC professor in both the School of Media and Journalism and the Skilling School of Public Health, and the editor of a new book called Misinformation in Mass Audiences, about a different sort of plague, the spread of health misinformation. Welcome, Dr. Southwell.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. This is such a big and important topic. Mm-hmm. And I know we're going to get into some really nitty-gritty, fun stories, but we'd like to hear your story a little bit first. How did you get interested in public health, and how did your career kind of evolve?
Yeah, well, that is a fascinating question. So I've long been interested in the public sphere and different aspects of how we communicate with one another. And public health, to me, actually offered a way to apply some of that thinking for the greater good. So actually, dating back now to the 1990s, I had an opportunity to spend some time at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And that was an interesting turn in my career because at that point in time, I ended up flying around the country helping with public service announcements, filming and taping PSAs in order to promote public health. And I've done a lot of work over the years in the evaluation of media campaigns and trying to understand how people interact with media campaigns. Along the way, one of the things that you realize is that people pay attention to a lot more than just public service announcements. They're getting their information from a variety of different sources. And so my career, my research career has expanded out to, think about everything from engagement with television sitcom, content to, the internet. And a lot of that, in a lot of ways, then over time, led to this question of misinformation then as part of that landscape and what it is that people do with that when they encounter it. But it all did really start with trying to use some of the skills and interests I had for the greater good.
I feel like misinformation in this day and age and around fake news really is, I think, scary when it comes to health information. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. You know, I think part of what's interesting about this question is that there is a lot to worry about in the current environment. At the same time, there's some older questions, you know, here about how we engage with information. In fact, you can see references to words like misinformation and fake news and others actually dating back quite a while, even decades past the current moment. And, you know, our systems for processing all this information also are a lot older than, you know, current technology. I think part of what's interesting in this moment is the quickness with which we can share it with one another. How quickly we can click on social media and all of a sudden it's, you know, spread. But we have these longstanding tendencies that I think actually are part of what make the issue really problematic. We have a tendency to, for example, accept information on its face. And there's some efficiency in that, but also there is a real issue or dilemma there. We also have social tendencies. People like to talk to one another. And they do it for a lot more reasons than just simply trying to glean what's truthful in an environment. That also complicates this when you're thinking about sharing misinformation. We also have a regulatory system in the United States that leaves the door open for some of this information to actually make its way out there. And that's actually, strangely enough, a good thing. And we can talk about that, too. So it's a problem that's been with us for a while, but it is a problem that seems to be exacerbated a bit by how quickly we can share information and just the flattening of the landscape in terms of credibility. You can log on and find information in all kinds of places now. And maybe that was a little bit different than used to be the case.
So if we're thinking about misinformation, and let's talk about that term, because it almost is like a sanitized version of the word lies, right? We talk about the misinformation as if there was something non-purposeful about it, but yet we tend to, I would say, think, well, there is something personal about misinformation, disinformation. So help us understand the terminology.
Yeah. You know, though, Adam, actually, one of the reasons we use the sort of more generic or broader term misinformation in the title of the book is that we actually were interested in this as sort of an umbrella idea. Because actually, that notion of disinformation, that notion of actively and purposefully, you know, lying is something we worry about quite a bit ethically. But there also are instances when I think mistakes get made or information gets out there and it's hard to discern what the intention was from an agency standpoint, from an authorship standpoint. We still worry about that as noise that might be in the system. It's also the case that if you think about the nature of science, we have a self-correcting institution, but the state of the art, you know, changes at times. There is information that inadvertently gets out there and it needs to be retracted. A famous article on vaccines and autism, for example. So not all of it's necessarily fully intentional, and we might worry about the whole wide range. That said, I think that, you know, we currently have a landscape where it's possible to generate information that looks like the front page of the New York Times, or it looks like it might be credible, and to post it and to have other people. The fact that we're all connected is part of the mechanism because we can share it, you know, so quickly. It's also the case that there are fake accounts that exist that perpetuate, you know, this information. But I do think it's important to recognize that not all of it's exactly the same, that it's actually not monolithic. My colleague Claire Wardle and other folks up at First Draft, it's based at Harvard now, have done a wonderful job of articulating this as a set of different possibilities. That it's not all just one, you know, category of misinformation, that some of it's maybe more worrisome than others even.
What about disinformation? What would be the difference?
Yeah. So, I mean, I do think there are instances in which people are actively, as Adam says, you know, lying, right? And so in a political arena, you know, there's really not – you can make a harsh judgment about that because it really shouldn't have a place in our civic discourse. But I also think there are instances where sometimes there's a misinterpretation of what was originally a credible finding. That then people take and run with that version of the headline, and then that gets posted. And they're trying to share this as something that they're either excited about. This might actually help with a disease that they've been worried about, or that they're worried that this is another indication of something going wrong. And so I think part of it is that old telephone game that you might have played with other friends. And things are sometimes two or three steps removed from the original peer-reviewed article. And then all of a sudden it gets twisted in a way that it's sort of circulating. I see this a lot in the weight management arena, for example, where There might actually be some kernel of truth, but then, you know, three or four steps removed, it becomes the latest fad in this new diet, and then people just sort of run with that. I tend to try to assume that it's not all a matter of bad actors, you know, here, that actually part of it's just the complication of our social dynamic, our social life, that leads to some of the confusion.
So if we're talking about misinformation, and sometimes it brings to mind to me some of the industries that perhaps have an interest. And the one that I know you and I both share, because we've done research on this, would be the tobacco industry, how through the marketing of the product, misinformation presented to people. To what extent do Americans believe misinformation when it comes? And is it really so simple as just presenting the misinformation, or does it have to fit into one's pre-existing belief, distrust over an official, let's say, government message?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot in your statement, Adam, that suggests, I think, this complicated reality. I do think we can go back to this, you know, centuries-old debate between a couple of philosophers, Spinoza and Descartes, about our nature of engagement with information. And the short story is that we actually do tend to believe things on their face and then figure out if they're true or false. And sometimes we're tired or fatigued, or we don't get around to actually checking ourselves. So I do think that there is a bit of tendency we have to believe. At the same time, there's certain information that, you know, does fit into our worldview that I think makes it easier to accept. We know that emotion, for example, plays a role. In instances when you're angry, you might be more likely to accept supporting information. And think about this when it comes to the case of health information. As it plays into some of our fears or other concerns, it might be that we're likely to latch on to information that seems like it could be true. Also think about, from an industry standpoint, this tendency to play on people's interests or hunger or fear and to try to give them what they want. You know, so from the standpoint of purveying misinformation, you have a bit of an advantage because you are trying to give people what they want to hear, and then correcting it, you're trying to tell them something that they actually may not want to hear to be true. And so that's actually also an imbalance that I think we might worry about, you know, as well. It also, there's a twist here that I think is worth thinking about too. We found, I should disclose, my group at RTI International, we've done some work with the Food and Drug Administration and looked at different types of inaccurate claims in health advertisements and in related advertisements. And there's a distinction you might make between what we might label errors of commission and errors of omission, instances where you're explicitly saying something that actually is not accurate, as opposed to errors of omission, instances where you're sort of leaving some pieces of the equation out. You're allowing people to infer, or maybe you're even implying something that's not quite accurate. We found that in trying to correct those two types of inaccuracies, the errors of omission are even a bit more difficult because there's not necessarily the exact cognitive architecture to attach a correction to. And we also know, for better or worse, unfortunately, some advertising strategy seems to suggest implication, seems to leave things out. The whole notion of a white lie, or the notion of there being something that, yeah, it's left to the, you know, viewer or the listener's imagination, but we sort of know exactly what this is implying. Those are a little bit more tricky. And there's another category as well, visual information, where we know that we actually don't have a syntax for labeling what's a visual lie in the same way that we do, like, verbal. If I speak a lie to you and your listeners right now, and I promise I'm not, but if I did, you'd be able to call me on it based on logic, based on syntax as to what I said. But if I depict something visually, that sometimes there can be enough plausible deniability to say, you know, we didn't really mean that. Get your mind out of the gutter. We didn't actually imply that. And that's, I think, the way that some of the advertising works, too. So that's another strategy that various industries have available to them that, again, is sort of biased towards giving people what they might want to hear, what seems to be true, playing into their, you know, sense of who they want to be aspirationally, that it's sometimes more difficult to pin them down. Joe Capella and his colleagues up at the University of Pennsylvania, where I had the honor of doing my own graduate degree, they have a chapter in our new book on the tobacco industry specifically and thinking about misinformation in that context. And it would be worthwhile for listeners maybe to check that out.
Yeah, well, we're going to need to take a short break. And when we come back, maybe we can come in and look at an example of omission and commission, this visual imagery. I'm thinking about in my own work how someone had a picture of what was supposedly a civil war in one area of the country recently, but it was actually a picture from the Holocaust that they were showing. and how that created all kinds of dynamics there, which really was problematic. But we're going to take a short break, and when we continue, we'll continue talking with UNC's Dr. Brian Southwell about a different sort of plague, the spread of health information. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Golston and Jamila Battle.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're talking with Dr. Brian Southwell, Director of the Science in the Public Sphere Program at RTI International, a UNC professor in both the School of Media and Journalism and the Gilling School of Global Public Health, and editor of the new book, Misinformation and Mass Audiences, about a different sort of plague, the spread of health misinformation. And we spoke about visual versus the syntax of verbal communication, and wondered if you had some examples of misinformation, either in that visual context or maybe misinformation around, let's say, the opiate epidemic and pain medication.
Yeah. So let's think about this in the pharmaceutical context just for a minute, because there's a lot of dimensions of a drug that somebody might want to have information about. And you think about what the drug is indicated for, what it's intended to do, what its risks and benefits might be. And it might be that there's a claim made that drug X is going to provide this type of symptom relief. And that might not be an accurate claim. So it'd be something that's explicitly said, and it'd be easy to say, you know what, when we said that, that wasn't actually correct. It'd be another thing to sort of present information and maybe conveniently leave out, the nature of some of the risks. Or you might even briefly state that, well, there might be some concerns with this. But, rather than, suggesting that you might actually have nausea, instead the reality might be that you'd have, really severe complications in terms of digestion. Or you maybe conveniently leave off that there's suicidal ideation that's, actually been associated with this. And things that get left out, can also be problematic, too. So I think there's a lot here. There are a lot of different ways to be inaccurate. I think that's probably the more important. And I think it'd be worthwhile for us to have different considerations and maybe even different remedies based on, the type of inaccuracy that, that you're talking about. So it all gets a little bit more complicated as you sort of think about the range of information that exists. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting, and just reflecting for a second again about the tobacco industry, we had this generation of believing that low-tar cigarettes were going to be healthier, and then the research kind of caught up and said, there was no health benefit. And now perhaps this move to low-nicotine cigarettes, which wouldn't be safer. They would just have less nicotine, so it's this complicated element. And then most recently, the industry has been required through court cases to put corrective statements. Mm-hmm. And so you see these all over the newspapers and on the TV with these corrective statements. And I wonder, to what extent are we able to correct misinformation when it's in the public domain? Because you mentioned vaccines and autism. It seems like now we've been spending a decade trying to correct the misinformation. And I don't know how successful we've been.
Yeah. So this is actually also an area that we've done some work on at RTI in collaboration with FDA, and some other colleagues have worked on this as well. And the short story is you actually can provide some correction. You can move the needle back to some degree when you are very explicit about it and when it's done, in a sort of at the same time as people are roughly, soon thereafter when people have encountered the original misinformation, for example, that can work well. But there are other complicating factors. And what sometimes happens is we'll put together a very dry, carefully accurate, factual statement, post it on a website somewhere, and say, well, it's out there in the world, and assume that's going to stand in terms of correction. This whole mismatch in terms of the dimension of exposure matters a lot. Imagine that the original offending piece of information was out in a Super Bowl ad, and then you're trying to, rather than fighting fire with fire, you're sort of putting something out, metaphorically in a brochure somewhere in a doctor's office. That's not going to work. We have to have both, I think, the nature of the exposure match, but then also you might think about how it is that information is packaged as well. What if, for example, there were disclaimers placed, but it's done, you know, with a green font or with some other thing that connotes some other association? That might also be an issue worth thinking about. And so there are many different ways that people, all these dimensions that you encounter, you know, when you're sitting down to watch a movie, you think about, you know, the music and the imagery and what's technically being said. All of that matters. And communication research would suggest that it all is fascinating in how it matters. We probably need to address all of that in correcting information as well. But we do have some evidence that it can actually be done. It's just going to be a matter of a lot of investment and being ready for the long haul, because it's not going to be done quickly on a simple post somewhere.
If I were one of the listeners, I would feel frustrated because I would think, gosh, if I listen to the news, I'm misinformed. But if I don't, I'm uninformed.
Right.
And you know, I would want to know, how can I protect myself from this information? How do I know what's important or relevant so that I can make an informed decision?
That's really a great point. And I think that it is possible to feel overwhelmed in the present moment. I think good advice for listeners is to do a few things. Develop a sense and a repertoire of credible sources, places that you know you can turn to that have been vetted. We're seeing a resurgence in interest in the credibility of certain journalistic institutions. There's a reason why peer-reviewed journals matter as a good outlet. There's a reason why science has the norms that it does, and we're sort of discovering those anew again, it seems. Triangulating information, I think, is useful. Seeing if you can find multiple ways to verify it is important. Probably recognizing that if something seems like it's too good to be true, that it may well be, especially if it's just from your Uncle Fred who forwarded it and he has a tendency to be a bit excited about these things. And recognizing that relying on Facebook as your news feed alone may not give you all the information that you want, that you might actually want. And it means taking an extra step to kind of verify, to have a little bit more of a sense of engagement rather than sort of passively looking at what just streams through your phone, really being ready to investigate a little bit. I think that's what I'm sure listeners of this show are used to doing some of that already. But I think for the general person sitting out there, that might be one way that you can take charge back a little bit of what otherwise can be an overwhelming situation.
Some of my own research, we've looked at credibility of organizations, and three things seem to be important: trust, expertise, and transparency.
Yeah.
You're going to tell people what the correct element is, regardless of whether it helps you or not. And I wonder, is there a breakdown in our society today on one, two, all three of these? And is this knowledge something that listeners can use to really see? Because they're judging, they're listening to us. Are we being transparent with what we're asking and talking about?
Yeah, that's really, those are wonderful to point out all of those dimensions, because I think they all do matter. It's one thing to have expertise in an area. It's another for an audience to feel like they share values with you and that you are doing something that's in their interest as well as yours. And that's really sort of a basis of this shared interest, I think, in terms of trust. And transparency, I admit, honestly, that in the last decade or two, I've grown frustrated at times because there are instances where I think there's become this professionalization of spokespeople and all that. And there's real cynicism sometimes where people honestly are doing whatever they can to be sort of technically accurate, perhaps, but shielding information that they know isn't going to be to their advantage. And I think that that's exactly right. I think demonstrating that you're willing to offer transparency wherever the truth may take you is really important. And we've got to get to that point. I think a lot of people are frustrated with our inability to do that. And some of this is really complicated, but some of it's so simple as spokespeople and others just asking themselves the question, do they really believe X or Y that they're stating, or is there a larger contextual picture that they could offer? Because I think in the long run, the credibility boost is going to be worthwhile. And I do think that there's an economic and financial model from a media standpoint too. I think you're going to find people that are, not everybody, but some people are going to be drawn to more credible sources. Is that consistent with what you all found in your work?
Yeah, it is. And I do worry, though, at times, and particularly today's times, for instance, is in terms of fake news, is that itself credible? Is the claim of fake news? Because it seems as one could latch on. And so I wonder, in healthcare, for instance, is this belief that as science grows, it disproves some other scientific principle? We find out that some drug was actually hazardous that we didn't think to start with. And so do we begin to understand that this is our evolution, and by printing this information helps us versus, that's just now part of the kind of fake science.
I'll offer a quick and succinct plea that maybe we try to retire that phrase. This is something that actually my colleague Claire Wardell, who I mentioned earlier, and others have tried to make an argument for that, because honestly, and it's maybe a strong statement for me to suggest this, but it's almost a lazy, really cynical way to address this. And especially when it gets attached to something that's just of a different opinion than, you know, as opposed to something that actually is factually inaccurate, you know, given all the facts at the time. So I think that label gets used way too much and in a way that's not helpful. And I think that that's actually something we need to move back away from, because it's actually undermining this for all of us in a way that I feel very comfortable saying that's not going to be optimal for any of us as we're trying to build a society.
And as we wrap up, are there any final thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Yeah. Well, first, I'd like to thank you both for putting attention on this as an important issue. I do think that it's important to recognize this is not something that just popped up in 2018. This has been with us for a while, and we can find our way out as well. I think there are some new initiatives. I'll call attention to a new initiative by the Rita Allen Foundation that I've been I had an honor to be a part of, called the Misinformation Solutions Forum. We're working on all this. We're going to have a meeting in D.C. this fall, so you can look up Misinformation Solutions Forum and Rita Allen Foundation and find more. And I think that together we can correct some of these concerns. It's important to recognize, though, some of this is going to happen naturally in a system like ours, because the alternative is censorship. The alternative is something that we wouldn't want. And so it's okay for us to live with a bit of misinformation. We just have to be able to be willing to correct it and acknowledge it, just like you all are doing. So thank you.
Well, we want to really thank you, Dr. Brian Southwell, for your work to really bring this issue of misinformation and media and communication to the public. And broadly, I assume you hope to teach this in schools of journalism and schools of public health and have this information, the science of this, become part of the discourse.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much for having me here to have this discussion. And certainly welcome, if listeners have ideas about this, they can reach me at RTI and we can talk more about it.
And we'll put the link up there. We've been talking with UNC and RTI's Dr. Brian Southwell about a different sort of plague, the spread of health misinformation. We want to thank him for being our guest. We're going to take a short break, and then coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 The Hill and UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Jamila and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about listener health questions and concerns. If a listener has a question they want us to address on an upcoming show, they can send a comment to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question. Laura?
I was in with my doctor talking about some pretty severe trauma in my life, and I noticed after a few minutes that my doctor was also tearing up. I found this really refreshing because it led my doctor to share some things about how important the experience that I had was to him as well, and I felt closer as a result. Is that unusual?
Well, we're certainly not taught in medical school that it's okay to be human sometimes, all right? It's like, I don't think that doctor planned to cry and thinking, I'm increasing my empathy here, but it happened, right?
It happens.
We're humans too, aren't we?
We are. And I think, you know, it shows that the doctor is authentic and transparent and probably strengthens that rapport with the patient.
You know, the same things that happen to patients at times can happen to us. We experience loss. We experience trauma. We experience anxiety, depression, fatigue. It can happen. Now, you may not want to hear that from your doctor, and I doubt the doctor is going to go routinely tell you about that. But if it comes out, it's probably a reason for that to come out, and that could be beneficial, right?
That's right. It could strengthen that rapport. I think it could maybe help the patient feel that empathy and really connect with that doctor in a way that maybe they would be more comfortable disclosing.
Yeah.
More information.
Yeah, now if your doctor cries every single time, that may be a little too much. Listen, this is such a touching thing, and we are touched by it, and we appreciate you sharing that. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I was referred to a psychiatrist last month for depression and anxiety management. However, the psychiatrist at the health center had no openings for 3 months. What other options do I have?
It's so, so difficult accessing mental health care for so, so many people, so, so much of the time.
Actually, it is. And this is actually why I trained a little bit more with mental health. So that way, when this happens to my patients, I can start that treatment and often bridge them to their psychiatrist. So I think it's important to know that family medicine doctors are trained in mental health, and we do see mental health complaints first line.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good point. I sometimes will say exactly that to a patient that, you know, this is a problem here. You know, I might be able to prescribe the medication for you, and I might be able to do some therapy, certainly listening and maybe some goal direction. However, I'm not a psychiatrist, and it may be beyond what I can do. I'm willing to start that path with you if you agree. So I think there's some shared decision-making, we like to say.
That's right.
Here. You know, it's not just like I can take care of this
exactly.
Or I can't take care of it. It's some negotiation.
That's right.
And the other thing that you might consider is a different type of psychiatric treatment. So there are others, particularly if you just needed therapy, you could try a social worker, a psychologist. You may not need a psychiatrist. And then there may be other mental health. Every county has a mental health system of care. There are free clinics where sometimes some of the psychiatrists. And then a little known trick, ask for cancellations. You ever done that?
You know what? That's a great idea.
Yeah, because there are cancellations, you know, all day long. And as a doctor, you're going, this person canceled and I had a 1 hour opening here. But you got to get on your feet and be ready and commit, because that may be a fleeting opportunity. But most times you can get in quicker if you're willing to do that. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I saw my family doctor a month before I was scheduled to have major surgery on my spinal cord. I was really worried and anxious at the time, and my doctor reassured me that I would be okay. She held my hand and told me that she would pray for me. I wanted to encourage your health listeners and doctors who may be listening to recognize how helpful and calming this was.
Well, that's just a really touching and important thing that we forget in a lot of our high-tech world of medicine, that there's also high-touch medicine.
And I like that. That simply shows the human element that I think sometimes can get lost with so much technology and access to, you know, social media and texting instead of calling. So the element of human connection, I think, is touching.
I think we sometimes forget that we can cure sometimes, we can diagnose most times, but we can give messages of hope almost every time. And if it's the other way around, that we're working on things, then we're going to be struggling ourselves and for our patients. And I think this reassurance, what do you think about the aspect of praying with the patient or praying for the patient? A lot of doctors may or may not feel comfortable with that.
You know, I think that if the patient is comfortable with it and that's a part of their belief system, I don't see anything wrong with praying with them or offering to pray for them.
Yeah. I sometimes will say, would it be okay if I kept you in my prayers? Would it be okay if I said some prayers for you over the next few weeks? And like, I've never had a patient say, no, don't do that. They're like, yes, I would really appreciate that. And so that's my comfort level. And I think finding your comfort, I think just as you said, Jamila, what the patient level and your level of comfort and finding a match there, but reassuring.
Exactly.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for all of our listeners for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you and your health. And you can share any question, story by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or iTunes. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship. I want to thank Dr. Jamila Battle today as our guest co-host and Dr. Brian Southwell as the guest today. Hope you'll join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health on demand at chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 The Hill, your community radio station.